Good morning. The State and Local Government and Elections Conference Committee will come to order. The time is Friday, May 9th, 2025, 9 a.m. Welcome. We're hoping that for today's conference committee, we could do a walkthrough of all the provisions, both state gov, local government, and elections, and then we will open it up for testimony. We have a long and growing list of testifiers. We're looking to give 2 minutes to testifiers, and then after that we will be adopting some of the agreed upon provisions, and we will look to adjourn as the House has floor session. And so with that, I don't know if maybe we could start off with we will recess, and then how about we start off with some introductions for members here on the conference committee, members along with staff. And so I am Senator Tu Zhang from Senate District 44, representing the northeast suburbs here in the metro, and thank you all for joining us. Looking forward to a productive conference committee. I'm going to hand it off to you.
Good morning. I'm State Representative Ginny Cleavor, and I serve as the co-chair of state government in the House. I represent House District 42B, which is Plymouth and Medicine Lake.
Hi, I'm Amanda Rudolph, the committee administrator for Chair Cleavor.
Mike Freiberg, State Representative District 43B, Golden Valley, Robbinsdale, parts of Crystal and Plymouth, co-chair of elections in the House.
Good morning, State Representative Jim Nash, representing District 48A. I am the Republican co-chair of the State Government Finance Committee.
My name is Jacob Grunhauser. I am the GOP Committee Administrator for State Government in the House.
State Representative Pam Altender from District 20A, and I'm the co-vice chair of the Elections Committee in the House.
Pat Kaluza, I am the committee administrator the Republican committee administrator for the Elections Committee in the House.
Matt Gehring from the nonpartisan House Research Department. I staff elections.
I'm Helen Robertson, House Fiscal Staff for State Government and Elections.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Colby Sullivan. I staff State Government for the nonpartisan House Research Department.
Good morning, Haley Bloom Peterson, Senate DFL Research.
Good morning, Sebastian Gonzalez, Committee Legislative Assistant to Senator Zhang.
Good morning, I'm Senator Aaron May Quaid. I represent Senate District 56, which is Apple Valley, Rosemount, and Egan.
Good morning, Beth Fraser. I am the Senate Elections Committee Administrator.
Good morning, Senator Bonnie Westlin. I am Vice Chair of Elections. I represent Senate District 42, which includes Plymouth, Medicine Lake, and a little bit of Maple Grove.
Andrew Erickson, Senate Fiscal Analyst.
Tom Watson, Senate Counsel, staffing local government issues.
Stephanie James, Senate Counsel, staffing state government.
Kayla Matanis, I am the CA for Senator Zhang.
All right, thank you, members and staff. With that, I'm going to hand it off first with the state gov staff for House and Senate to give a walkthrough of the side-by-side.
Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the State and Local Government and Elections Conference Committee. I think please state your name and you guys may begin.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, again, Andrew Erickson, Senate Fiscal Analyst, and I'll just be walking through the spreadsheet of the side-by-side with Ms. Roberts here, just to orient you to the state government spreadsheet. You'll see that these are change items only, so the amounts in the columns are increments over the base funding. Generally from the general fund, although you'll see a couple of other funds in the column labeled fund. You'll see the Senate columns in blue, followed by the House columns for the current budget biennium. a difference column showing the difference between the Senate and House positions, and then in the far right columns, the same except for the Tails biennium of fiscal year 28 and 29. So beginning along the left side here, we have the legislature starting on line 5. The Senate side has a $4.622 million operating adjustment. The House is carrying the same operating adjustment at a slightly lower $4.60 million. There is a House operating adjustment in the Senate bill of $7.3 million. The House position is $13.9 million. The bills are carrying identical amounts for LCC operating adjustments and dues increases of $3.956 million and $123,000, respectively.
And then moving over to the House column, you can see that there is funding for the, within the LCC for additional revisor staffing. The Senate has one-time funding for a task force on best practices for appropriating money for grants. And then there are two House provisions, one additional funding for the Office of the Legislative Auditor Special Review Unit, and then funding of both of these are $579,000 for House File 3, that's Representative Nash's bill related to audit implementation and monitoring with the OLA.
For the state auditor, the Senate is carrying a $681,000 operating adjustment. The House number is $2.036 million, along with change items for a data warehouse of $456,000 for the biennium and IT auditors for $560,000. We'll return to this later, but some of these amounts are offset by statutorily required receipts for through billings.
Moving down to the Attorney General, both the House and Senate have funding for the operating adjustment at different levels. The House is at, or the Senate is at $1.976 million and the House at $3 million for the 26-27 biennium. Then in addition, the House and Senate both have funding for a one-time adjustment, the Senate at $250,000, the House at $750,000. The Senate has additional funding of $5.8 million for the operational and staff increase, and then the House has additional funding of $782,000 for Medicaid fraud division staffing increase. Both the House and Senate have an increased appropriation from the State Government Special Revenue Fund, and this is for providing legal services to the health licensing boards.
For the Secretary of State's office, the Senate is carrying a $578,000 operating adjustment, and the House has that amount at $1.1 million. It's probably worth pointing out that the Senate also has a $1.42 million operating increase, it's labeled, on the Senate side. The operating adjustments generally reflect the amounts that are carried that were in the governor's proposal, and the operating increase is any amount over that. There's also in the Senate side a $690,000 the first year and $610,000 ongoing for Senator Klein's Senate File 1734 fraudulent business filing removal process. The House is carrying a similar amount in the Special Revenue Fund, which you'll see just below the line there.
The next agency is the Capital Area Architectural and Planning Board, and you'll see that both the House and Senate have funded the governor's requested operating adjustment. I think as we get later in the spreadsheet, we might go through those in clumps because we have quite a few small agencies that all just received the operating adjustments. But the next agency is Administrative Hearings, so you'll see there, again, there's a general fund operating adjustment of $30,000, both for the House and Senate, and both the House and Senate fund the increased request for an operating adjustment out of the workers' compensation fund.
For Minnesota IT Services, the Senate is carrying a $564,000 operating increase, and the House is carrying a $1.2 million decrease. For the Department of Administration, the Senate has a $911,000 operating adjustment. The House decreases the operating adjustment by $1.018 million. Both bills are carrying a reduction in the transfer made annually to the Enterprise Translation Office special revenue account of $150,000 each year for a net $300,000 biennial reduction. Both bills are also carrying an in lieu of rent operating adjustment of $2.875 million for the biennium. The Senate also has $5 million for two grants to Ramsey County for capital area livability improvements and a grant to St. Paul, Minnesota Foundation. This is related to a later reduction to an appropriation that was made 2 years ago in the state government bill related to, not the state government bill, I think it was the jobs bill, from an account that is being repealed in the Senate side. Finally, there was some unassigned public broadcasting grant funding in the base from the 2023 state government bill. The Senate is reducing a certain amount of that to $500,000 total, and then letting the rest presumably not cancel because it was never appropriated back to the general fund, but not picking up a base amount that was in existence but not assigned to anything. The House is not making that reduction and is fully assigning it to the public broadcasting grants.
Moving down to Minnesota management and budget, both the House and Senate provide funding for the operating adjustment at different levels, the Senate at $2.7 million for the biennium and the House at $1 million. The Senate also funded the governor's request for enhanced oversight capacity at $688,000. Both the House and Senate are tracking a reduction in the fiscal year 2025 funding of $1.7 million. This is related to data disaggregation project funding that is not needed. And then finally, the House has funding of $2.35 million for the biennium for the Healthy Aging Subcabinet. This was Chair Cleborn's provision. And then moving down, the final cabinet-level agency is the Department of Revenue, and you can see there's a $2 million difference between the House and Senate funding for the operating adjustment, the Senate at $2.7 million and the House at $10.7 million.
Moving to the Racing Commission, related to an item at the bottom of the spreadsheet, there's an increase to a fee for advanced deposit wagering regulation, and that amount is deposited into a special revenue account, which is statutorily appropriated to the Racing Commission. This is the spending side of that, of $875,000 for the biennium. Both the Senate and the House are carrying this provision. The next one, as Ms. Roberts suggested, is the first of many small agencies that are getting operating adjustments. In this case, it is the Amateur Sports Commission of $28,000 for the biennium. And this will continue through some of the next councils, but there is a difference that the Senate is carrying additional operating adjustment or operating increase money for some of these other councils. The first of those, the Minnesotans of African Heritage Council, is a $34,000 operating adjustment, with the Senate also carrying a $225,000 biennial operating increase. For the Latino Affairs Council, the operating adjustment is $36,000 in both bills and $272,000 in the Senate bill for an operating increase. For the Asian Pacific Council, the operating adjustment is $28,000 for the biennium. For the LGBTQIA2S Plus Council, it is $24,000 for the operating adjustment and $460,000 for additional staff in the Senate bill. This is one where the House does also have an operating increase of $200,000. The last of those councils would be the Indian Affairs Council, with an operating adjustment of $61,000 for the biennium.
And then moving on to the Minnesota Historical Society, both the House and Senate provide $925,000 for the operating adjustment. In addition, the House has $100,000 for the Farm America Interpretation Center. That's an increase to the base. For the Minnesota Arts Board, the House and Senate both fund the operating adjustment. And then the next four items are all occupational licensing boards, again, funded at the governor's level for the operating adjustment, with one difference being in the cosmetology examiner's board. The Senate is $10,000 higher for that board. And then the final item is a House-only provision that is for the an appropriation to the Department of Children's, Youth, and Family, and this is related to transit assistance program integration, and then there is a revenue item related to that at the bottom of the spreadsheet. Oh, sure. Moving down, we'll start going through the revenues. The first item is a House-only provision on line 154. It's related to the accountancy board certificate requirements. So there's a small revenue gain there. And then the second item is what I just mentioned, the Children, Youth, and Family Department, the federal participation offset revenues. Underneath that, you'll see the state auditor, as Mr. Erickson noted, that some of the appropriations earlier in the spreadsheet are offset by these revenues that come through the audit program, both for the operating adjustment and the IT auditors on the House side.
For the Secretary of State, the Senate bill increases certain business filing fees by $5 to $10, and that is expected to raise annual revenues of $732,000 or $1.464 million for the biennium. There's a blank line for the State Board of Investment where neither position picks up a governor's proposal related to that board.
And then moving down onto the non-general fund revenues, you'll see an item for the Secretary of State. This is related to the similar Senate proposal for business filing fraud, but the House uses a one-time or a late penalty that is deposited into the special revenue fund. So similar provisions, just treated a little differently. And then you'll also see the non-general fund revenue from the Raising Commission advance deposit rate wagering.
And Mr. Chair, I think that brings us to the end of that spreadsheet. I would just ask, do you want us to continue into the elections one, which is relatively short while we're sitting here?
Yes, or please.
Come back? Okay. So you'll also have in your packets the elections spreadsheet. This one is much shorter. It fits on a single page. And so just moving through that fairly quickly and remembering that the elections jurisdiction covers the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board and elections-related change items at the Secretary of State's office. The Senate bill is carrying $260,000 related to voter outreach efforts. Both bills are carrying a $200,000 one-time transfer to the Help America Vote Act to match federal funds. Both bills are carrying a $79,000 operating adjustment to the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. The Senate bill is carrying $500,000 one-time for litigation expenses. There is also, you'll note in the fiscal 25 columns, a reduction of negative $2.1 million. This isn't a change item so much as it is a recognition that there's an error in the fund balance related to a statutory transfer for the public subsidy program. And so this is just recognizing the error in the fund balance. It was built, in my understanding, into both the House and Senate targets here. Moving to line 22, you'll see that there is a revenue line for the Senate bill in which in fiscal year 28, the Secretary of State would bill the major parties eligible to participate in the presidential nomination primary for the expected costs of that primary. It doesn't touch the statutory appropriation, but this is recognized as a revenue that comes back and is deposited in the general fund. There's also a one-time transfer on line 31. The Senate bill repeals the voting equipment grant account and transfers the remaining balance into the voting operations technology and election resources account. I don't think the House has any other provisions that weren't being carried by the Senate, so that should be the full picture for the election spreadsheet.
All right. For the walkthrough there, shall we move on to the side by side then? Representative Cleavorn or Representative Nash, do you have any comments?
No.
All right, then we'll move on to the next piece. Ms. James? All right, thank you both. Whenever you are ready to go, you can fire away.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Again, Colby Sullivan with the House Research Department. Ms. James and I will walk through fairly briefly the side-by-side documents for state government, walking through the language. I know we don't have a lot of time this morning, so we will be brief, but please let us know if you have any questions. So I'll start with the side-by-side document that should be in your packets. At the top, it's titled State Government Policy, dated May 7th at 3:28 p.m. Just to orient you a bit, the Senate language for Senate File 3045 is on the left. The House language is on the right. The House had a separate policy bill for state government, so in certain areas on the House bill, for example, with Section 1, you'll see the reviser noted that this section is from the House policy bill rather than the finance bill. So starting off with on page R1-A2, Sections 1 in both the House and Senate designate the state fossil. Section 2 is House only on the right-hand side, state constellation. The House would designate Ursa Minor as the official state constellation. Then Section 1 from the House's state government finance bill, deployed member proxy voting. This section would allow members of the House and Senate who are deployed on military orders to designate a proxy to vote on their behalf. The bottom of page R1A2 is also House only. It's to be the first of three sections that deal with the Legislative Coordinating Commission. Section 3, Chair and Vice Chair, just clarifies that both the Chair and the Vice Chair then rotate between the House and Senate every 2 years. On to the next page, top of that page, Section 4, Definitions, would define the LCC as a joint legislative office. And Section 5 just clarifies when the legislature appropriates money for joint legislative studies, who the appropriations should be directed towards.
Members, the next item is on page R2. It's Section 2 on the Senate side. This provides for the Senate to elect its president from among its members.
Mr. Chair, then we have a House-only section on R3-A2, Section 2, Leaders. This would allow the House and Senate, through their rules committees, to designate one additional member to serve in a leadership position. And then moving on, bottom of R3, start some sections that are exactly the same between the House and the Senate, and these are all pertaining to the Office of the Legislative Auditor. So you've seen these members before, so I'll move on, unless there are any questions, to R4. Again, at the top of that page, same sections, House and Senate, pertaining to the Legislative Auditor. And then at the bottom of R4, on the House side, Section 3, Implementation of Audit Recommendations. This is from Chair Nash's House File 3 that Ms. Roberts mentioned during the spreadsheet walkthrough. It would require the legislative auditor to submit a report to chairs and ranking minority members of legislative committees every year regarding implementation of recommendations issued by the legislative auditor within that committee's jurisdiction. There's another section later in the side-by-side that requires the Minnesota Management and Budget to report to OLA also annually regarding agency implementation of OLA recs. So then moving on to page R5, House-only language, sections 4 and 5, preparation duties and distribution. Under current law, only the chair of legislative committees and the chair of Ways and Means and Finance can request fiscal notes. This House language would clarify that ranking minority members may also request fiscal notes through the Legislative Budget Office. Then, starting on the bottom of R5, House Section 6, Healthy Aging Subcabinet. This is Chair Cleavorn's language. Her bill that Ms. Roberts mentioned would establish a Healthy Aging Subcabinet to basically oversee healthy aging issues and to coordinate the work of state agencies who have programs that affect aging adults. That language stretches for a few pages all the way through the end of R9. So moving on to page R10, then at the top of that page, we're still House-only language authority. This is the first of a series of sections in the House bill that pertain to Medicaid fraud. These were requested by the Attorney General's office. The Section 7 authority would allow the Attorney General to subpoena additional information as part of an active investigation. Then the bottom of that page, R10, House Section 8, Duties and Powers, and then also onto the next page, Section 9, Annual Report. These were changes requested by the State Board of Investment, and it would move the deadline for the State Board of Investment's annual report from December 31st to March 31st each year so that the report could be issued after the board's annual audit is complete. Then on to page R12. These are two sections, Senate Section 6, Contracts, and House Section 9, Contracts. These are identical and basically create an exemption for the State Board of Investment from new procurement contract term prohibitions that are established later in the House and Senate bills. Section 10, House only, procedure when data is not accurate or complete. This has to do with when a subject of government data basically questions the accuracy of data that a government agency holds about them. If they don't like that agency's response to their inquiry, they can appeal. So this really just allows the state agencies to provide non-public data to the Department of Administration as part of that appeals process. On the bottom of R13, then, House Section 11 data sharing would allow government entities to share data with one another, non-public data, when that data is part of suspected fraud committed against government programs. Then on to page R14, these are House and Senate sections that are identical. Senate Section 7 and House Section 12, creation. These are requests by the Office of Administrative Hearings to change their name and statute to the Court of Administrative Hearings. And then on to page R15, these are again Office of Administrative Hearings request. The language is very similar between the House and Senate, and this would allow agencies to request remand when they're not satisfied with OAH decisions in a contested case hearing. Moving on to R16, House Section 17, program payments withheld for fraud. This was also part of the governor's anti-fraud package and would allow state agencies to withhold payments to a recipient when the recipient is part of an active investigation concerning potential suspected fraud against state government programs. Then moving on to R18.
Members, I failed to identify myself when I first started speaking. I'm Stephanie James, Senate Counsel. The next item is on page R18 on the Senate side, Senate only. This is a requirement for that commissions and task forces in all multi-member agencies except licensing boards expire after 2 years unless another date is specified in their enabling statute. And the next item is a House only. Well, it's the same on both sides. On Section 13 on the Senate side and Section 18 on the House side. This requires heads of agencies to ensure that employees' concerns about the misuse of public money are promptly directed to one or more of the obligated officers. This is part of the OLA package that Colby described earlier.
Mr. Chair, then we have a House-only section, House Section 19, also found on page R18, organizational charts posted. This would require state agencies to clearly post on their website a current organizational chart that includes the name and contact information for certain agency leaders.
The next item on page R18 on the Senate side is Section 14, local news organizations. This encourages agencies to spend half of their advertising budgets with local news organizations. It also provides for a reporting by February of 2026 and then annually thereafter on advertising expenditures.
Mr. Chair and members, on the R19 on the right-hand side, House-only Savvy program. This would basically reestablish a state agency value initiative or SAVI program in the executive branch where state agency employees could identify innovative cost savings and efficiencies, and the agency then could retain 50% of the cost savings. That amount would carry forward into the next year and would not cancel back to the fund from which it was appropriated. As drafted, this language would, or this program would expire on June 30th of 2030. Then on page R21, we have House-only language, House Sections 21 and 22 that pertain to the Compensation Council that determines salaries for constitutional officers and agency heads and also recommends compensation or salaries for the judicial branch, judges and justices in particular. The House language would change the timing of the Council's recommendations regarding judicial salaries from April 1st of odd-numbered years to September of first of even-numbered years. That's Section 21. And Section 22 clarifies the prohibition on ex parte communications between members of the Council and those for whom they set or recommend salaries.
The next item is on the bottom of page R21, Section 15, a Senate-only provision that precludes the CAP, or the Capital Area Architectural Planning Board from adopting rules that specify a minimum amount of required parking.
Mr. Chair and members, on R22, house-only language on the right-hand side, House Section 10, this is the other piece of Chair Nash's House File 3 that I mentioned, the piece that requires MMB to report annually to OLA regarding the status of implementation of OLA recommendations.
On page R22 on the bottom left is Section 16 of the Senate's. This modifies the due date for MMB's annual report regarding the budget reserve adequacy.
Mr. Chair, members, on R23 on the right-hand side, there's a house-only section lapse. This is just a conforming change with the SAVI program that I described earlier regarding the cancellation of funds. Then we have a series of sections that are the same between the House and the Senate. These were requested by the Department of Administration. Again, members are probably very familiar with these, and because they are the same, I will move quickly through those. Those sections continue throughout R24 and R25.
On page R26, on the left side, Senate only, Section 21, this establishes an account and a process for agencies to seek funding for projects that relate to renewable energy and storage and charging stations and electric fleet vehicle projects. And then the next item on page R27 as a series of provisions. On the Senate side, it's sections 22 through 27, and on the House side, it's 28 through 30 that are similar but a little bit different. And these require a state employee to report evidence of a violation of laws governing grants. In place in law right now is an encouragement for employees to make this report. So on the Senate side, the Senate requires employees to do this reporting. That's the Senate's change. In the House, they have some additional items besides that. There's an addition of a requirement that the employees make the report promptly, and also that a manager is an person to whom employees are allowed to report. It adds manager to the list of allowed entities to which the employee can report. It also it removes a limit on the data that the Office of Legislative Auditor has to provide to the Legislative Audit Commission, and it also adds a step of requiring the employee's supervisor or manager or commissioner to report to the Legislative Auditor.
And Mr. Chair and members, there's a House-only section on R29, the right-hand side, creation and validity of grant agreements, section 31. I mentioned earlier a section in the House language that requires agencies to post organizational charts. This is also from House File 2, this section 31 on the House side. Similar requirement, but applicable to state grant recipients. So as determined by the Commissioner of Administration, recipients of state grants would need to post certain contact information and leadership info on their websites during the duration of the grant agreement. Then on the bottom of page R29, kind of a continuation of the package that Ms. James was describing. These are grants management changes. These changes were requested by the Department of Administration, are the same between the House and the Senate, as are Senate Section 27 authority and House Section 33 on the bottom of page R30, also pertaining to state grants.
Members, on page R28, I'll note that the Senate has a Senate-only provision on kind of in the middle of the page, Section 23 there. This is a provision that requires state agency staff to be trained in grants management if they're going to participate in administering state grants. There's initial training and then annual retraining required. On page R31, on the Senate side, there's a Senate-only provision that requires that a contract between the state and federal contracts authorize the state to withhold payments of the federal money that's being passed through the contracts. when a state official or an employee has a reasonable suspicion that the recipient has secured the payment through an intentional or deceptive act to gain unlawful benefit. And then section 30 is on the bottom of page R31, section 30 on the Senate side and 35 on the House side is the beginning of a few sections that are the same between the House and the Senate. These eliminate an existing exemption about the requirement for contractors with the state who are from small businesses or small targeted businesses to not have to abide by subcontractor requirements. And that's the same in both bodies, in both bills. So that's section 30 and 35 on the bottom of page R31. On page R32, the Senate has a Senate-only section that pertains to the definition of small business. This allows the Commissioner of Administration to establish their own definition or some other definition of small business. Right now, they're required to use the provision in the Federal Code of Regulations. I've already described the subcontracting exemption in section 32 and 36 on page R32, and that also it flows through three sections. Also, the next section 33 on the Senate side and 37 on the House side, and 34 on the Senate side of page R33 and section 38 of the House side. And then the next section is on page R34. On the left side, the Senate section 35 and the House section 39. This extends a deadline for a report on uncollectible debt. The same in both bodies. On page R35, the Senate side, section 36, this makes modifications to the pharmacy benefit procurement process. And that goes through page onto page R36 and section 37 on R36 and section 38 on page R38. And these changes have to do with providing greater flexibility for being able to pick two separate vendors for the benefits and the management of the benefits. And some other provisions relating to the technology platform provider. The next section on page R38 is on the Senate side, section 39, and on the House side, section 40. It's the same on both sides that provides for the spouse of a retired employee to be able to continue to be to participate in CGIP if their retired spouse becomes eligible for Medicaid.
Mr. Chair and members, then on page R39 on the House side, section 41, House only. This is a request by Minnesota Management and Budget to clarify the destination within the state treasury of money transferred from the Healthcare Access Fund for the provision of insulin. Then starting on the bottom of R39 with House Section 42, the definition of fraud. This is for purposes of the State Whistleblower Protection Act. Let's continue on to all of R40 and the top of R41 and would expand protections for state employees who make a good faith report to the named entities at the top of page R41 regarding anything really to do with state programs, including but not limited to fraud or misuse, or suspected fraud or misuse. Then on page R41, Senate section 40, payments to state and House section 11, those are identical and would increase the regulatory fee for advanced deposit wagering in Minnesota. Then at the bottom of R41, we're back to the Attorney General's Medicaid fraud prevention package requested section 12. A lot of these are just conforming changes due to the fact that, as you'll see later on the House side, the House would repeal the existing crime of Medicaid fraud and replace it with a new criminal statute. So then moving on to page R42, though, we're moving to a different topic, which is the state lottery and its contracting with lottery retailers. The House and Senate language is, there are technical differences here, but otherwise the body has really passed substantively the same provisions in this area. So I'll move past those. They're on R42 and R43. R43 has to do with criminal background checks of retailers. Both the House and the Senate picked up the state lottery's request to modify these statutes, just happened to do so in a technically different manner. Then if we go on to R44, again, we're still state lottery with technical differences. So then we can move to page R45, where we have House-only language. House Section 46, this is the threshold for requirement for cities with municipal liquor stores, whether the financial statements they submit to the state auditor must be audited before submission or not. Under current law, it's $350,000 in annual liquor store sales. That would be increased to $750,000 under the House language. Then here's the medical assistance fraud new crime statute that I talked about, Section 21 on the House side. You can see there's a graduated scale of penalties depending on the severity of the theft or fraud committed against the medical assistance slash Medicaid program. That continues through all the bottom of R46, where House Section 22, acts constituting theft. This is elimination of the existing crime of medical assistance fraud. That continues through 48 and 49 and page 50. Actually, all of 52, these are just conforming changes to the creation of a new Medicaid fraud crime. That continues through about two-thirds of the way down on page R51.
And at the bottom of page R51 is a Senate-only provision, Section 45. This is a review of multi-member agencies. This requires the Legislative Coordinating Commission to submit a report to the legislature listing multi-member agencies, not including licensing boards, and then provide some information about those, the enabling statute, the expiration date, the dates of the most recent three meetings, group duties, and their work product. And then on the page R52, another Senate-only provision, this establishes a new task force on best legislative practices for appropriating money for grants, describes the membership of the commission. It provides for the task force to develop recommendations and advice to the legislature for best practices for appropriating money for grants and for determining when to appropriate money through competitive grant programs and when to appropriate money to a named organization, and when services could be procured through contracting. The group would expire January 31st, 2026, or the day after delivering its report.
Mr. Chair and members, House-only language on R53, House Section 47. This pertains to the provisions I mentioned earlier, changing the timing of the Compensation Council's judiciary recommendations. This would revive the 2025 Compensation Council to make those judicial salary recommendations in 2026. Section 24 would require the Commissioner of Management and Budget to submit reports to the legislature next biennium regarding the number of posted but unfilled executive branch job openings in the prior 6 months. On R54, then, we have House-only language, Section 25, integrating application information. This would require the Department of Children, Youth, and Families, in consultation with Metro Transit, MnDOT, DHS, and Minute, to integrate into the MN Benefits web portal information so eligible applicants could apply for the Transit Assistance Program. Section 26, statute replacement. This would allow the Department of Administration to accept private funds and submit a request to the Joint Committee on the Library of Congress to replace one of Minnesota's two statues in Statuary Hall in the U.S. Capitol in Washington, D.C. Section, at the bottom of that page, revisor instructions. These are the same between the House and Senate and pertain to changing the name of the Office of Administrative Hearings. On page R55, there's a House-only revisor instruction at the top, technical and related to the Medicaid fraud package. And then we get to the repealers for both bodies, the statutes that the two bodies propose to repeal. There are a lot of similarities here, although there are different bold titles for these subdivisions. The statutes often are exactly the same that would be repealed. I'll just point out a couple of House-only provisions. The House would repeal legislative commissions. That's subdivision one, starts on page 30.4. I have a list of those commissions that I can provide if members would like. The House would also repeal the employee gain sharing program through Minnesota Management and Budget and the Advisory Council on Infrastructure at the Department of Administration.
And the Senate has a repealer that's only on the Senate side, and that is to repeal the statute that allows agencies who administer grants to retain specific amounts of the grant money, 5% for grants to named entities and 10% for grants awarded through a competitive process. The Senate also has a repealer in the Board of we haven't gotten to licensing boards yet.
Mr. Chair and members, then we'll move really quickly to the separate side-by-side called State Personnel Management. This is long, but I can summarize it very quickly in that these are requests from Minnesota Management and Budget. There are really just technical differences between the House and the Senate here. I think staff, we would recommend with the House language just because it includes a couple of additional conforming changes.
And members, the next article is on the Senate side, licensing boards. And the Senate has provisions relating to three different licensing boards. One is the Board of Cosmetologist Examiners, one is the Board of Architecture, Engineering, Land Surveying, Landscape, Architecture, Geoscience, and Interior Design, and then a set of provisions from the Board of Accountancy. The provisions from the Board of Cosmetologist Examiners are sort of a reworking of provisions adopted last biennium that deal with preparing stylists to work with aestheticians to work with hair of different textures. Senator Champion carried the provision when it was passed last biennium, and he carried the provision to sort of rework the laws around this. And then the next, and that's sections 1 through 4 and 17 of the Senate Article 4. And then the Board of Architecture provisions are sections 5 through 12. These are Senate only. They lower the practice requirements to be a member on the Board of Architecture. It eliminates an age requirement to be licensed in one of these professions, and it adds a requirement to comply with the Board's rules of professional conduct. It eliminates a requirement that a person involved with issuing licenses be certified in a relevant position, and it requires an applicant to provide evidence of having passed examinations. And then it eliminates a fee for a temporary license for former and current military members. And then lastly, the Board of Accountancy, these are very similar between the two bodies, minor technical differences. Changes the requirements for education and experience required to be certified as a public accountant. The new requirements would be in full effect June 30th, 2030. Between now and June 30th, a person could be certified under either of the requirements for experience and education. And then lastly, we have an article dealing with the Secretary of State's business filings and fraud in those filings. So these are generally the same with minor technical differences. We have a little bit to figure out on the effective dates, but not a substantive difference, just some technical differences. So that's sections 2 through 16 of the IA 5 document. And then finally, the Senate has a whole article, Article 6, that increases various business filing fees imposed by the Secretary of State. And the House has one more provision.
Yeah, the House, as an alternative, has a late penalty or a late renewal penalty that would be assessed against those who apply to reinstate a business entity that previously expired due to failure to reinstate or to renew that business entity on time. That would be up to $25 as determined by the Secretary of State, and the money would be appropriated in a dedicated account it would be deposited in a dedicated account and appropriated to the Secretary of State for designated purposes. Mr. Chair, with that, we've reached the end of the side-by-side walkthrough.
All right. Thank you for giving us the walkthrough there. Members, we will transition to the local gov piece, and then we'll open it up for questions afterwards. All right. And then elections following Mr. Rogers. All right. Whenever you both are ready to go, please state your name for the record, and you guys can proceed. Thank you.
Hello, Tom Watson, Senate Counsel.
Morning, Chair and members. My name is Chelsea Griffin. I'm a legislative analyst with House Research. We will be looking at the side-by-side that has the dash A7 page numbers. It's titled Local Government Policy, and it compares Senate File 3045, the third engrossment, with House File 2098, the second engrossment. The House had a separate local government policy bill. Beginning on page R1 to R3, there's House-only language. This adds the members of the Metropolitan Council and certain Metropolitan Council employees to the definition of public official for the purposes of personnel data on government employees under the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act. This would authorize all data relating to complaints or charges for these individuals to become public under certain circumstances.
On page R3 is the Senate-only provisions. Sections 1 and 2 amend the open meeting law to allow members of certain public bodies to participate remotely in meetings governed by the open meeting laws from a location that is not open and accessible to the public. Under current law, a member may only participate from a non-public location 3 times a year and only for certain reasons.
Page R4, Section 2 on the House side, doubles the maximum reimbursement amounts allowed under current law for an appraisal of property that's conducted for a property owner whose property is being acquired through eminent domain. Page R5, the language of Section 3 on both the House and Senate side is the same, provides that public water district, sewer district, or combination water and sewer districts can install water and sewer lines within public road right-of-way. Section 4 that begins on page R5, it's Section 4 for both the House and the Senate, and carries on to page R6. This is similar between the House and Senate. The language authorizes the posting of a public notice on a political subdivision's website when there's no qualified newspaper due to the discontinuance of the newspaper. There's a small wording difference, and the effective date is formatted differently, but both sections are effective the day following final enactment. Page R6 to R7, this is Section 5 on both the House and Senate sides. This provision raises the revenue threshold for towns that combine offices of clerk and treasurer and are required to perform audits annually to $1 million adjusted for inflation. The previous threshold was $150,000. The Senate includes a conforming change to the city auditing provisions, which we'll talk about later in this walkthrough.
And on R7 is a Senate-only provision. It's two sections, 6 and 7, that are in R7 and R8 that together create the Ramsey County Economic Development Authority and set out the powers of that authority. The sections also grant the powers of the newly created Ramsey County Economic Development Authority to the existing Ramsey County Housing and Redevelopment Authority, and the section will be effective after Ramsey County complies with requirements for special laws. On R8 and to R9, Senate Section 8, House Section 6 are the same. They delete a specific number of deputy administrators from the St. Louis County Civil Service statute. On R9, Section Senate 9, House Section 7, these are also the same, and they raise the annual audit revenue threshold for cities that operate under the standard plan of government and combine the offices of clerk and treasurer also to a million. This is part of a package of changes that all make similar adjustments.
Page R9 to R10, sections 8 and 9 on the House side, provide statutory cities the option of establishing a public utilities commission with 3, 5, or 7 members with staggered terms. It authorizes the number of public utility commission members to be increased or decreased by ordinance, but subject to a reverse referendum. Then on page R11, section 10 on the Senate side and also section 10 on the House side, this is another auditing provision that raises the annual audit revenue threshold for cities that operate under optional plan A. And this raises the threshold to $1 million adjusted annually for inflation.
Also on R11, there's a Senate-only provision, Senate Section 11. It amends the section of law that governs tort liability for political subdivisions to expressly include public water and sewer systems formed under Chapter 116A. On R12, another Senate-only provision, Section 12, it permits cities, towns, and fire departments to allow certain individuals who volunteer to provide emergency services to purchase tires for their personal vehicles under the contract that the city, town, or fire department uses to purchase vehicle tires. The volunteer may purchase up to 4 new tires for 1 personal vehicle every 3 years and must pay for the tires, including taxes and fees, from their own funds.
Page R12 to R13, there's a House-only provision. This requires cities and towns to provide landlords with a link to the electronic version of the Attorney General's Landlord-Tenant Guide upon issuance or renewal of a rental license or registration or certificate of occupancy. On page R13, there is a provision. It's page or section 13 on the Senate side and section 12 on the House side. This is similar between the bills. The provision amends the law requiring local governments to provide financial reports to the state auditor to provide that towns cannot receive state aid if they don't comply with the requirements. And the House also adds special districts. Page R13, section 14 on the Senate side, section 13 on the House side is the repealer. These are different. There is a provision that's the same between the repealers, and it repeals some St. Louis County statutes that relate to the lay members appointed to a board or commission by the St. Louis County Board, and also some provisions in the St. Louis County statutes that relate to annual appropriations of county funds for county historical society work. The Senate also includes a repeal of the state law that prohibits political subdivisions from banning stores from providing customers with disposable plastic or paper bags. Then on pages R13 to R15, there's House-only language that relates to a joint powers hospital district in Swift County. The language reduces the number of board members of a hospital district in Swift County from 9 to 12 down to 6, and it also authorizes the hospital district to change the number of board members through adoption and amendment of bylaws. There are technical changes made throughout to the 1992 special law that correct an erroneous reference to a provision governing the bylaws of the hospital district board. Chair and members, that concludes the walkthrough of the local government article.
All right. Thank you both for the walkthrough there. And then we'll move on to the election portion. All right, the moment we're all waiting for. Welcome. Please state your name for the record, and you may begin.
Mr. Chair, Matt Gehring from the House Research Department.
Lexi Stengel from Senate Council.
And as we walk through the election side by side, what we're going to do, I think, because there are a lot of topics that sort of bundle together within the side by side, instead of going through the statutory side by side line by line, we're going to use the comparison document that should be in your packet. That'll make things a little bit more efficient in terms of understanding what all is in the in each body's bill. So we'll start with the Elections Administration article. So this is Senate Article 8 and House Article 5. Largely. So this is a document comparison of Senate and House elections provisions. The first two items are House-only items. Item one on the comparison document you'll see is House-only language, which appears in sections 1, 2, 44, and 45. These are changes that come from a bill proposed by Representative Jones, which amends the laws that govern access to multi-unit dwellings like apartment buildings by both United States Census workers and candidates for office. These changes would include a notice requirement, so a person accessing a building would be required to provide 24 hours notice and specifies times during which access must be provided from 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. on any one day.
Item two
is House Section
4. Mr. Chair, Senator Zhang.
Yes, Senator McQueen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am so sorry. I think I lost where you were starting, and so I am not following you. Can you repeat where you're starting?
Senator Schur. So we're working from the table document titled Comparison of Senate and House Elections Provisions. And there's a separate one that we'll go through next called Senate and House Campaign Finance Provisions. So we're on the elections provisions right now. So item one on that document is the access to multi-unit dwellings that I just discussed. And then item two is a House-only section, House Section 4, that provides a standard for determining the residence of a person committed to a secure treatment facility as a sexually psychopathic personality or sexually dangerous person, and that residence would be their last known address prior to the commitment order. And that is the definition that would be used for determining their residence for purposes of voting.
On line three of the document, there are several sections that relate to amending sections of law to specifically allow for updating voter registration. You'll see that there are some asterisks next to several of these sections that refer to specific line numbers. These sections that are indicated like this do a variety of things, so those sections are included on various lines of this document. So on this particular line, those line numbers refer to these pieces of those sections that talk about updating voter registrations. On the next page, on line four, there are two sections, both section five for the House and Senate, and this has to do with voter registration in residential facilities. It strikes a requirement for a residential facility operator to prepare the list of employees that work for that facility. And instead requires employees to provide proof that they are employed with that facility before vouching for residence. And it provides an immediate effective date. The difference is that the Senate has an immediate effective date and the House has an additional requirement that an election judge may not sign a proof of residence oath vouching for an individual who appears in the precinct where the election judge is working, and requires the Secretary of State to publish guidance for residential facilities and residential facility employees on the vouching process, not voicing process, that's a typo. On the next line, line five, there are similar provisions. They are both section six. This has to do with voter registration and additional proofs of residence for students. And it specifies that the additional proofs of residence for students must be allowed during the 18 days before an election and on election day. The difference is that the Senate requires additional residential housing lists to be certified to the county auditor no later than 35 days before the election instead of 20 days. And the Senate provides an effective date. Then there are Senate-only provisions that are some minor changes, and you can see the list of sections there. They have to do with striking a reference to precincts where voter registration is not required. That's Section 8. Section 13 rewrites a sentence to make it a more clearly written sentence and strikes a reference to pre-registration. Section 17 and 21 update some terminology to use the word individual instead of person because that's more consistently used throughout the statutes. Section 38 strikes the dates for initial reports related to website security assessments. Because those initial reporting dates have passed, it does not eliminate the requirement for the ongoing report, though. Section 72 updates terminology to refer to voters with a disability and specifies that assistance to the voter is at the request of the voter. And then last, it includes part of the repealer, which is a township voting equipment study that was completed in 2016. On line 7, there are a variety of changes related to the absentee ballot application and the deadlines for returning those. There are 3 Senate sections, 10, 25, and 94, and 2 House sections, 7 and 8. Without going too far into details on those, they have to do with Senate 10 and House 7 have to do with the absentee ballot application, including a box to indicate a voter's preference to be returned, preference to join the permanent absentee voter list. The difference on those sections is an effective date. Senate 25 and House 8 amend the deadlines for returning the absentee ballot, require the Secretary of State to put information on their website after that deadline about how to vote, and require certain information to be included on the registration form. You can see on the summary document that there is a list of all of the various differences between the House and Senate. And then Senate Section 94 is a Senate-only provision that provides a transition to new voter registration application and absentee ballot application forms to accommodate for the change in permanent absentee voting. On line 8, there's a provision that's Senate-only, that's Senate Section 12, and this requires the public voter information list request to be provided within 5 business days instead of 10 under current law. On line 9, there's some changes related to combined polling places. Senate Sections 22 and 50 have to do with using electronic rosters in combined polling places, and the House takes a different approach.
I should note there, Mr. Chair, that the House language is sort of substantively different from the Senate in that it includes language that requires the Secretary of State and County Auditor to provide guidance to election judges on procedures to ensure that each voter is provided the correct ballot in that precinct. And then also that in combined precincts, a map showing precincts served by the combined polling place must be posted at the entrance, and a notice that multiple ballot styles are being used must also be posted near the entrance to the polling place. Then line 10 is similar language between the House and the Senate. Senate Section 27 and House Section 9 relate to the designation or notice that a municipality will administer absentee voting laws in place of the county auditor. The Senate language includes an alternative procedure for specifically for in-person absentee voting. The House language, kind of substantive difference here is that the House language specifies that if a county auditor designates to a municipal clerk to administer absentee and early voting laws, that the designation is only effective if the municipal clerk accepts that responsibility. Line 11 relates to the return of absentee ballots. Again, there are policy differences in between the House and Senate in these sections. This is Senate Section 31 and House Section 10. There's some language that is similar. There's terminology regarding absentee voting envelopes and how the envelopes are referred to. The policy difference here is the timing for return of absentee ballots. The Senate provides that absentee ballots delivered in person must be returned by 3 p.m. on election day, and after 3 p.m., the county auditor or clerk must post a notice with information on how voters may vote in person on election day. And the House language provides that absentee ballots delivered in person must be returned by 5 p.m. on election day. Line 12 is a sort of extended section in this comparison. This is all identical language related to election and miscellaneous election administration provisions. There's language here regarding absentee voting envelopes, procedures of absentee ballot boards to make sure that the number of absentee ballots that are removed from a ballot box are equal to the number of ballots from the tally of ballots received on that day. There's language between both bodies, again, identical, specifying that the absentee ballot application deadlines do not apply to emergency response providers. There's language related to early voting officials that requires them to remove, secure, and document ballots received during each early voting period on each day. And then there's language towards the end related to filing periods for municipal elections and the timeline for calling a special county election. Again, all the sections that are noted here in line 12 are identical between the House and the Senate. Line 13 relates to temporary polling locations. Both bodies provide that a federally recognized Indian tribe with off-reservation tribal lands may request an additional polling place to be placed on that land. The difference here is that the Senate requires that the notice of the absentee polling places being designated be posted on the county auditor's websites. The notice must be provided as soon as practicable and no later than 5 business days after designation or receiving the notice. And the notice must include the polling place's address and the dates and times the polling place will be open for voting with a September 1st effective date. The House language is a little bit shorter and just provides that notice must be posted within 5 business days. And a separate notice must be provided for each primary and general election.
On line 14, there's a Senate-only provision at Senate Section 34. This has to do with absentee voting in healthcare facilities and allows that if a healthcare professional at one of these facilities determines that it's necessary to ensure the health or safety of the election judges, the voters, or other people at the facility, 2 employees of that facility may take the ballot from the election judges and deliver it to the patient instead of the election judges, and then have the person vote and then return the ballot to the election judges.
Then line 15 is a House-only provision, House Section 13, which relates to data practices access to absentee ballot applications. This section would make public the date in which an absentee ballot application is signed, the date it was accepted, and the method of its submission.
On line 16, there are several Senate sections, 35, 57, part of Senate 63, 76, 77, and 83 that provide that election judges in standalone county, municipal, and school district elections are exempt from election party judge balance requirements. On line 17, Senate Section 36 and House Section 14 are similar, and they amend how absentee ballot signature envelopes are handed. This requires counting, cross-checking, and accounting for empty signature ballot envelopes at various steps in the handling and processing of absentee ballots. Discrepancies must be noted in the ballot board incident log and reported to the official responsible for the ballot board. The differences are that in the Senate language, all envelopes must be retained for the duration of the contest period. And in the House, the ballot board is prohibited from disposing or destroying ballot envelopes until 30 days after the deadline for bringing an election contest expires. Or if a contest is filed, then the deadline is 30 days after the completion of the contest and any related appeals, whichever is later. On line 18, there's Senate only Section 39. And this specifies that if a county and a municipality agree that the county's ballot board will retain responsibility for UOCAVA ballots, then the county retains those ballots after they've processed them instead of delivering them to the municipality. On line 19, another Senate-only provision, Section 44, requires affidavits of candidacy to include a phonetic spelling or pronunciation of the candidate's name or a certification that they're okay using the technology's default pronunciation. On line 20, there are a series of similar sections, Senate 45, 47, part of 48, 52, 54, and part of 63. And House 19, 20, 21, 23, 25, 32, 33, 34, and 48. And these are all similar sections with minor differences, and they include 45 and 19, Senate 45 and 19 have to do with candidates for judicial office, county attorney, and sheriff not having to include their address of residence, but must now include a phone number and email address, and requiring if bills are used for proof of residence, that bill must be recent. The difference there is that the Senate has an immediate effective date. Senate 47 and 48 and House 20 and 21 have to do with candidates who are absent during the filing period must include proof of residence. The difference here is that the Senate has an immediate effective date and specifies that copies of bills are private data on individuals and includes a cross-reference to the Data Practices Act. Senate 52 and House 23 requires notice to be posted in a conspicuous place if a polling place is changed. There's some details on what that would look like. The difference is a technical difference and some wording differences. Senate 54 and House 25 require the development of chain of custody plans for the elections in the counties, and there's some differences there in how the local plans should be developed and used. Senate 63 and House 32 required jurisdictions that conduct election by mails to send ballots no later than 28 days before an election. The difference there is an effective date. Senate 68 and House 33 add a reference to updating voter registration on election day and strikes a reference to prohibiting to a prohibition on candidates from assisting voters, and the difference there is an effective date. Senate 69 and House 34 strike the requirement that all election judges initial the backs of ballots, and the difference there is a use of the word all ballots versus ballots. Senate 92 and House 48 require the election of municipal officers held after the incorporation or consolidation to be held on a uniform election date. And again, the difference there is an effective date. On line 21, there is a Senate-only provision that applies to third-party presidential electors and requires them to file a petition, and it includes certain information on that petition. On line 22, there are several sections related to changes of names on ballots. That's part of Section 48, Section 78 and 81. This requires the officials that receive filings of office to notify the official responsible for preparing ballots to any changes for candidates to be placed on that ballot within a specified timeline. On line 23, Senate-only Section 49 amends the timeline for write-in, people who want their write-in votes to be counted. On line 24, Senate Section 51 changes the deadline for when municipal boundary adjustments take effect from 21 days before an election to 46 days, so that boundary adjustment doesn't take place in the middle of an absentee voting period.
Then, Mr. Chair, item 25, line 25, is House Section 24. This is a House-only section that prohibits a polling place from being located in any location or in an adjoining room to a place where cannabis products are served or sold.
On line 26 is Senate-only Section 53, and when a polling place is changed because of an emergency, it requires that notices must be posted about the change of polling place, and there's some requirements about what that signage must look like and include.
Then line 27 is a House-only section, House Section 26, that applies election judge party balance requirements to any location where ballots are being counted, recounted, or reviewed, and each major political party must be represented by at least one election judge in each precinct. Then line 28 is language where there are policy differences between the House and the Senate related to the appointment of election judges. These sections, these are Senate Sections 55 and 56 and House Section 27 that amend the process for providing lists of individuals willing to serve as election judges that are submitted by the major political parties. These sections generally specify information must be included on the lists, and if required information is not included, the name must not be forwarded to an appointing authority. On the Senate side, the Senate provides a March 1st deadline for submission of lists by each major political party and specifies that election judges for a ballot board must be appointed by the municipality's governing body. The Senate also requires that the appointing authority contact each voter on the list about their interest in serving as election judge. The Senate also requires appointing authorities to first exhaust the list of voters provided by the political parties before appointing other individuals to serve as judges. And these sections are effective in 2026. On the House side, there's an April 1st deadline for submission of these lists by major political parties, and then further allows each party to designate names on the list of individuals who are available and willing to serve as alternate election judges in the case of unexpected vacancies or if all positions representing that party cannot be filled. If necessary, the county auditor or municipal clerk is required to notify party representatives if there's a need to request additional names. And the Secretary of State must provide a form that may be used by political parties to recruit individuals willing to serve as election judges. And that form would be required to include a space for a person to indicate an interest in traveling outside of their precinct to serve as an election judge or to serve as a member of an absentee ballot board. Line 29 Senate Section 58 and House Section 28 is similar language related to the election judge oath. The Senate, both the House and the Senate expand the wording that's used for the election judge oath. The Senate uses a more specific cross-reference to a statute on election intimidation and interference with the voting process as part of that oath. And the House uses more general terminology referencing election judge's performance of duties as an election judge and expanding the oath. Line 30, election judge training. This is a House-only section, House Section 29, that requires county-administered training programs offered to election judges to be consistent with the training programs that are required under current law to be established by the Secretary of State. And then line 31, there are policy differences here. This is Senate Section 59 and House Section 49 related to the number of election judges in each precinct. The Senate removes an exception that allows untrained judges to serve in precincts with less than 100 individuals, or where less than 100 individuals voted in the last election. Excuse me. And the House just repeals that subdivision. Line 32, House Section 30, is a House-only section that requires the Secretary of State to provide a dedicated telephone line for use by election judges on each state election day. The line would be available for election judges to clarify procedures related to election administration when the offices of the county auditor or municipal clerk cannot be reached.
On line 33, it requires the Secretary of State to maintain an election reporting system. So it essentially codifies the current system that they're using. It assigns responsibilities, timelines, and testing requirements for that system. On line 34, it's a Senate-only Section 61 and allows municipal clerks additional time to secure election supplies from the county before an election. On line 35, there is a policy difference between Senate Section 62 and House Section 31. This relates to the errors and omissions process. This allows for, in both sections, allows for service by emails, provide a process for parties to agree on a remedy to correct an error, omission, or wrongful act without going to court, and an official may correct an official ballot without a court order if the ballot is not in compliance with the laws and rules on ballot format. In the Senate section, it provides for a candidate who does not prevail in a court proceeding to pay costs and disbursements for the prevailing party under certain circumstances, and there's a June 1st effective date. On line 36, there's a Senate-only provision that adds a piece to the polling place roster that refers to the location of residence, and this is a conforming change to some changes that were made in law over the last couple of years.
And then, Mr. Chair, line 37 is a House-only section, House Section 35, which permits a voter who needs physical assistance in marking a ballot to request the assistance of two election judges at any location where ballots may be cast, which would include early and in-person absentee voting locations and also in a polling place on election day. Line 38 relates to voters who are unable to physically enter a polling place. There are policy differences between the two bodies. This is Senate Section 71 and House Section 52. The Senate strikes language referencing the polling places where ballots or electronic voting systems are used and specifies that the assistance of election judges must be provided upon the request of the voter. And the House adds references to locations where ballots may be used for early and in-person absentee voting.
Excuse me, Council. If I may interrupt, I would like to ask the chair a favor.
Senator Cleveland, Representative Cleveland.
Sorry. Thank you. So we are doing a walkthrough, and there are people who have traveled here to give public testimony, and I'm wondering if you would be gracious enough to allow us to pause the walkthrough. If we have to adjourn for Co-Chair Nash to get to the floor as whip for the House session, I think it's only appropriate that we allow those who have traveled to come and testify to have a moment to do that while they're here today. And we could resume this, if you will permit me to ask, at our next gathering.
Thank you, Chair Cleveland, and I think we have members that will be in other conference committees, and they won't be able to come back with us if we do come back later today, and so I'd be fine with that.
Will you please forgive me for interrupting your presentation, please?
It was very good, by the way.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Maybe we can wrap up this couple of sections here, and then we'll open up for the testimony, and maybe we'll try to figure out who came the furthest, and they'll go first. Mm-hmm. All right. All right. Continue.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Cleaborn, we're happy to, we'll defer to all of you, but we're happy to pause this. Just really quickly then, line 39 relates to legislative vacancies and special elections. The House provides a new timeline for filing affidavits of candidacy in those cases.
On line 40, there are two Senate-only sections on section 80 and 84 that have to do with amending the timeline for local canvassing boards. On line 40, there are two sections related to school district elections, changing the filing period, and providing that if a municipality conducts elections by mail, the school district, the school board may designate a polling place not used by the municipality. On line 42, there's a Senate-only section 86 that requires public notice that amends the testing, public accuracy testing, and provides for additional notice and makes some other more technical-ish changes. On line 43, there are three Senate-only changes that require the Secretary of State to bill the major political parties for their portion of the presidential nomination primary. If the parties do not pay for their portion of the primary, they are not allowed to participate in the primary for that year.
Then, Mr. Chair, the last House-only section for this part of the walkthrough is line 44, which prohibits election judges from providing public access to passwords that are used in a polling place.
On line 45, Senate-only section 90 strikes obsolete references to separate ballots and ballot boxes in town elections. On line 46, Senate-only section 93 changes filing periods for hospital board elections and requires the hospital district board to act as the canvassing board. On line 47, requires the Secretary of State to do statewide voter outreach efforts with the goal of increasing voter turnout and focus on counties with the lowest voter turnout. There are some additional requirements there, including a report to the legislature. Line 48 repeals the voter equipment grant account, which Mr. Erickson talked about earlier. Line 49 repeals the statute related to the inspection of ballot. That's a Senate-only section. And then finally, there's a Senate-only section with a default effective date of July 1, 2025. And that's our walkthrough, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for the quick wrap-up there. Appreciate it. And then now we'll move transition quickly to testifiers. So first up on the list, I'd like to ask Gregory Wright, County Commissioner, Olmsted County. And then have next up after Mr. Wright is Michael Stahlberger from Blue Earth County Property and Environmental Resources right after him. And we will be timing the testimony to 2 minutes as the list is quite long. And so Mr. Wright, whenever you please state your name for the record and you may begin.
My name is Gregory Wright. I'm a county commissioner from Olmsted County. I'm speaking in favor of the Healthy Aging Subcabinet. As a county commissioner, I am well aware of our aging population. There is no statewide strategic plan to guide the counties as to how to prepare, coordinate, and deliver the programs that will be needed. Without a comprehensive and strategic state-led plan, 87 counties will be left to their own ability and means to prepare for the challenges of an aging county. If the counties could do this on their own, they would have already done it. Aging is a public health issue and a bipartisan concern for our aging demographics. Minnesotans are all aging and require comprehensive planning and policies that support our aging population at every stage of life. Democrats and Republicans, if you're not aware of this, age at the same rate. It makes it a very bipartisan issue. The number of disabilities as well as healthy aging issues is equally distributed among the Democrats and Republicans. The issues that face our aging population are the same regardless of a rural or urban setting. An aging population requires a comprehensive plan and effective infrastructure to address the aging challenges of Minnesota. The aging of Minnesota requires a comprehensive, strategic, and long-term plan to address the many issues of aging to assure a quality of life at every stage. The impact of aging of an aging population has only begun to be realized. The aging population cannot be stopped, but its impact can be mitigated by a state-led strategic plan and a creation of a well-developed policies. The need for health and active services for the elderly can be estimated. However, without a strategic state plan to address the needs, it is an empty exercise. The issues facing the aging population include, but are not limited to, the workforce, transportation, health care, including dental care, housing, coordination, and streamlining of confusing and disjointed policies. And it will take a strategic plan to break through the silos that have been already established.
All right, Mr. Wright, please wrap up your thoughts.
Yes,
there,
and thank you very much. I appreciate that. Let me just say that the sub-cabinet, along with participation of the counties and citizens, will provide the strategic plan that Minnesota needs to address the issues of our aging population. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Wright. Next up, Mr. Michael Stahlberger.
Good morning, chairs, members of the committee. My name is Michael Stahlberger. I'm Director of Property and Environmental Resources for Blue Earth County. Today, I'm representing the Minnesota Association of County Officials. That's Minnesota's 87 auditors, treasurers, finance officials, recorders, and also elections administrators. I am providing MACO's input on county-specific election provisions in the conference committee report, primarily Article 5 in the House and Article 9 in the Senate. As many members on the committee are aware, MACO has worked this session to provide a MACO County Elections Bill that included 12 proposals brought forward by county election administrators statewide. It represents opportunities to update and address administrative and other technical elements in election law, and it attempts to increase understanding and transparency for voters. MACO has worked with local government partners such as LMC and AMC to fine-tune these proposals along with the Secretary of State's office. We've had many discussions with legislatures and received positive feedback from both chambers and both parties. The standalone bill had bipartisan authors. MACO is pleased to see that all 12 of those provisions were included in the Senate article of the bills in front of you today, and we respectfully request they be included in the conference committee report. MACO is also supportive of many other elections-related provisions, including removing the option to be added to the permanent absentee ballot mailing list as part of the registration process. That was House Article 5, Section 7, and Senate Article 9, Section 10. The non-judicial ballot errors and omissions process that was presented earlier in the recap is also something that our association strongly supports to ensure that we can have accurate ballots available to voters as soon as possible. We'd also like to point out that MACO appreciates any sort of continued funding at whatever level possible for the Voter Fund, the Voter Operations Technology and Elections Resources funding that was created a couple years ago and is exclusively in Senate Article 1, Section 40. This is a recognition that elections do cost money, and oftentimes those costs are borne by taxpayers at the county and city or township level. MACO also would like to continue conversations on two provisions that you'll be discussing throughout the conference committee process. The first one is regarding the defined processes for absentee ballot processing. While most of the counties already do the tasks that are provided in the law and the language being presented, having those clear expectations will lead to even more consistency and transparency, which we respect and support. We do have some concerns about the length of retaining the emptied ballot envelopes, and so the discussion that will be had around that will be something we'll be interested in pursuing.
Thank you, Mr. Stauberger, for your testimony. Sorry, we have to move on to the next one.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Next up, Leif Grinja, and then after that, Mr. Roger Day.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name's Leif Grinja. I'm the president of the Minneapolis Regional Retirees Council, a constituent body of the Minneapolis Regional Labor Federation, representing affiliated union retiree organizations in the Western metropolitan area. I'm here today to urge your support for Article 2, Section 6, the Healthy Aging Subcabinet. Now, my guess is that everybody in this room hopes to grow old. It is everyone's aspiration. It's something that, despite our differences, we all have in common. Those of you who are not yet considered elderly, what may you expect? As you age, many of you will remain a vital part of our communities. You will join a volunteer workforce of over 300,000. You will be among the largest number of people in the category of family, friends, and neighbors providing child care. Many of you will staff food shelves, volunteer in your churches and communities, and you will be in a demographic that votes in a higher percentage than any other age group in the state. But we face growing challenges as we seek to age with dignity and security and remain engaged in our communities. Challenges presented by health, access to health care, challenges presented by meeting rising housing costs on fixed incomes, challenges presented by transportation, financial security, and more. The public and private sectors provide a variety of resources, but they are scattered over a bewildering number of offices and departments in various levels of government and private nonprofit agencies. It seems as if no one, no entity, is responsible for planning and coordination. We are stumbling blindly into our future, the future for all of us. We need a subcabinet on healthy aging so that rather than stumble into the future, we can clearly see our way. We noted a minute ago, aging is in everybody's future. Doing it well is in everybody's interest. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Grinja. And next up, Mr. Roger Day. Hello, welcome to the State and Local Government Committee. Please state your name for the record and you may begin.
Thank you.
You can be seated too.
I apologize, but I've got a disability.
Certainly, sorry about that.
That's complicated. Yeah. It's partly physical and partly emotional. And it's the emotional part that's keeping me from sitting down right now. This is a really, really emotional occasion for me. I need your help, and you need mine. Right now, we are all being harmed. We are all being harmed by a massive forensic medical fraud that does more damage than the annual state budget in its entirety. So we have a gigantic problem and a really big opportunity to make it right. Again, I am a doctor. I am a lifelong resident of Minnesota. Born in 1960, got my medical license in 1990, and in 1991, the state started to commit a fraud in the matter of that license, and that fraud has grown daily for the last 12,000 days or whatever. So we have a massive 34-year combination of malfeasance and malignant nonfeasance. There are a lot of people in this state who already know about this fraud. And some people I just notified a couple days ago. Some people I've been notifying for years. The fraud is entirely publicly visible. You do not have to trust a single word I say. I only say things that are publicly, independently verifiable. Okay? And so what you can all do, and really should, is go on to the state's website for regulating medical licenses. It has a page for each medical license. You put in the credential number on the professional profile page, and it shows you the regulatory documents on that license.
Well, Mr. Day, could you wrap up your thoughts?
There are five documents, and they are facially fraudulent. And so when you look at them, you see five things created by our Attorney General's office and put into law.
Okay.
These things were created mostly by Skip Humphrey and Mike Hatch. These are federal.
All right, Mr. Day, please wrap up your thoughts, and I will meet with you.
I ask you to come with me, and I will listen. So, and take the notes.
No, this is information
here,
for
Mr.
The
Day. We have to move on to the next testimony.
So I understand that our time is limited. I've been asking the legislature for disability accommodation to be able to make my statements more timely.
All right, Mr. Day, we're going to move on to the next testifier.
Please look up June 17th, 2005.
All right, thank you.
Page 10. There should be two signatures on it, and there's only one for the state and not for the licensee.
All right, thank you. Next up, we will have Mr. Devin Bruce.
Everybody needs to look this up. This is a job for Donald Trump.
All right, Mr.
Deal with. This is a massive fraud that kills.
All right, we're gonna have to move on to the next testifier.
Please,
thank you.
Help our country.
Next up, Mr. Devin Bruce, and then after Mr. Devin Bruce, we have Anastasia Carrera from Common Cause. And so could you please make your way up, and then we will move on to the next testifier. Welcome to the State Local Government Committee. Please state your name for the record, and you may begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Devin Bruce. I'm the Director of Legislative and Political Affairs for the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees, a union representing over 19,000 state employees across all agencies, boards, and commissions. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify on the bill with just a few things that I'd like to lift up. One, first, we really encourage the committee to adopt the operating adjustments for agencies at the levels largely reflected in the Senate position, with exceptions to three specific areas, the state auditor, the Office of the Secretary of State, and the Attorney General's office. As noted in their letters and prior testimony, the governor's recommendation significantly shorted their offices in their budget request, recommending only about a third of their operating adjustments to maintain their critical services. We'd also like to voice our strong support for the expansion of the Whistleblower Protection Act. Currently in Article 1, Section 42 through 45 of the House position, and encourage the committee to consider further expansion of the protections included in number 6 to include all public employees, not just state employees, as was done on the Senate floor as well and in the Senate committees. We also appreciate your the inclusion of numerous anti-fraud positions regarding the grants administration, particularly the clarification around the payment withholds and when they are authorized, particularly for our employees who are doing grants administration. And then finally, we would also note our specific concerns around the language in the Senate Article 2, Section 48, Subdivision 5 of the State Government Policy Side-by-Side, which removes agencies' ability to use certain percentages of grants for the cost of administering. This was originally put into place to set a ceiling on the percentage for administrative grants and the appropriations if they do not provide a specific amount for the withhold. We understand why some advocates support the change, but the fluid nature of the legislative process, as well as the litany of grant requests, make it near impossible to effectuate the actual cost of proposals, leaving it up to either advisor to make a guess of how much it would cost or having the agency eat the cost for it, which could be substantial, and particularly in competitive grant processes. Thank you again for your consideration. We appreciate the time.
All right. And we have Anastasia Carrera as the next testifier, but I wanted to pitch this to Representative Nash, and I hope Representative Cleveland would be back. It's almost 10:45. I know you have to be on the floor. I'm not comfortable with us adopting and then having to cut folks off. And so maybe we could do that in the next committee hearing. Chair Nash.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I think if you wanted to wrap up testimony, then we can do the adoption of the things that we agreed on yesterday between the chairs at our next meeting.
Yes, and I think we will not be back today, as we will be on the floor, and members have to be in other conference committees too, including myself. All right, Ms. Carrera, welcome to State and Local Government and Elections Conference Committee. Please state your name for the record, and you may begin.
Thank you so much. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Emma Rage. I am the Policy and Civic Engagement Manager at Common Cause Minnesota. My executive director is Anastasia, and she was unable to join us in person, but she has submitted some supplemental information for y'all. Should be in your folders, and is always happy to connect if you have any questions on what she submitted. For those who are unfamiliar with our work, Common Cause Minnesota is a nonpartisan nonprofit organization working to create an open, transparent, and accountable government. And although we do have a C4 arm, we use it exclusively for lobbying. We never endorse political parties or candidates. I am here today with the support of over 1,100 multi-partisan statewide petition signers who have signed on urging you, our legislators, to make bribery and solicitation of voters illegal in Minnesota, and we urge you to please adopt the Senate's language, including the $5 cap that aligns with current laws. We're grateful to Senator Westland for moving the language in the Senate and addressing the practice of having outside super PACs and dark money influence elections by offering voters money in exchange for their alignment with a political party or candidate. This is an unacceptable practice, regardless of whether that money is DFL or GOP backed, and it is not a partisan issue in our opinion. The fact is that no one should be allowed to buy anyone's vote. The provision offered in the Senate language provides clear guidelines and accountability, protect the integrity of our republic's democratic process, and safeguards our right to cast votes based on the merit of candidates and free from undue financial influence. We firmly believe candidates and political parties should earn our votes and not buy them, and this is not a red or blue matter, it's a core American value. Members, please include Senate provisions making bribery and solicitation of voters illegal, as this language is critical to ensuring Minnesota's elections reflect the will of the people. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, ma'am, for your testimony, and the time is well past 10:45. Thank you, members, and for the members of the public, we will continue on with our next conference committee, and the information will be posted online. And with that, we are adjourned.